The views expressed on Skeptically Speaking do not necessarily reflect the opinions of the University of Alberta, the Students' Union, or CJSR.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to Skeptically Speaking, the show that asks you to call in and question everything. I'm your host, Desiree Schell. I'm wondering if any of you have ever been in this situation. You think of a fantastic methodology for a controlled, randomized study that, when completed, would answer once and for all some fascinating scientific question. And then you realize that going about that research would be totally and completely unethical to the people involved. That happens to me all the time. And it's too bad because we really could solve that whole nature versus nurture thing just by keeping some kids in cardboard boxes until they're 18. But since we can't, today we'll have Nancy Walton on the show to explain the ethical issues involved in researching humans. But to start off, someone has some speaking up to do. I have Joey Haben on the line. Hello, Joey.
Hi, Desiree.
Thanks for being here.
It's really nice to be here.
So Joey is the author of Newly Nerfed, a blog about disability, skepticism, and assorted geeky stuff. And she's here to talk about her personal experience with skepticism and health. So go ahead, Joey.
Okay. Well, I spent my whole life in perfect health. And then at the age of 30, I broke. It started with a bad case of mono that kept relapsing, and 6 years and several chronic illnesses later, I'm now disabled. During the course of those 6 years, I was doing a lot of stuff. I worked as a sign language interpreter, finished my master's coursework in teaching English as a second language, I got married, and began teaching college English to underprepared deaf students. And now, in 1 month, it'll be a year since I've had to quit working altogether, and I still haven't really adjusted yet. And during this period, I also became very interested in skepticism, largely through Michael Shermer's writing and then joining the Skeptic Society. I also discovered a form of skepticism practiced on internet communities for chronic illnesses. When I first came down with an autoimmune disorder, the people on that forum taught me a huge amount about the science behind the disease, how to read my own lab results, and both implicitly and explicitly, how not to trust what a doctor tells you solely because he's a doctor. And I don't mean that conspiracy theory brand of like mass medical paranoia. I just mean that I was well taught to advocate for myself. And I discovered I was being horribly mismanaged. My medication was 20 times more than I was finally prescribed once I got rid of that doctor. So that was a great lesson in critical thinking, and I've learned a lot more from personal experience since then. And also, now that my health is a lot worse and I'm more involved with other chronic illness forums and like Twitter communities, I'm noticing that while there's still a lot of healthy skepticism about the scientific side of things, when it comes to complementary and alternative medicine, I just don't see as much critical thinking there. And the reason I noticed this is not because I'm pointing fingers. It's because I went through my own period of, I will do anything to fix this. People with chronic illness will often grasp at anything, especially when there is no cure, and the best that can be done is to try to feel better. And there's a little part of me that will never be able to fault people for that. I have the skeptic community to thank for reigniting my sense of, wait a minute, before I shell out, what am I getting into here? And what I really hope for the chronic illness community is to remain skeptical on all fronts, to learn as much as you can about your illness from reliable sources, and to question anyone who offers you a cure or a solution of any kind. The people who prey on the sick and disabled come in a variety of very tempting guises. There are real as well as fake doctors who offer bizarre and or extremely expensive treatments. And there are also fellow patients who want to sell you their pseudoscience. And a mix of fatigue and pain and cognitive dysfunction can very easily stop people from looking too far beyond a really attractive come-on from a quack, or thinking too much about what's in that homeopathic treatment that's supposed to make you better. we have to remember that because we're all so linked together on the internet and elsewhere, if there were some incredible miracle cure, everyone would know about it, not just that one guy who has some website somewhere. We have a lot of reasons for not wanting to look too deeply into this stuff, but we do not have any excuses, especially when there is such an easily accessible skeptical community to learn from.
Joey, you rule. Honestly.
Oh, wow, thanks.
So your experience really is quite suitable for this show because it really is about questioning everything from your doctors to alt health salespeople to your fellow patients. So how do you think how do your doctors feel about the questioning?
My current doctors are all fine with it because I've weeded out the ones who aren't. I do want to just specify that I don't actually question everything literally. I'm not that nightmare patient who like comes in with 30 billion questions and doesn't believe anything the doctor says. When you find doctors that you trust, the nice thing is, you can let down your guard on some things, and then there's less need to question everything.
Right. So it sounds like there's a fine line between advocating for yourself as a patient and just being cynical about the medical community.
Yes, there is. It's a very fine line. I don't think I know anyone with chronic illness who isn't cynical, because we've all had just very bad experiences with doctors. But the thing is, you don't have to bring that with you either, you know, to the doctor. You don't have to bring that attitude, and it certainly doesn't. You don't have to write off the entire medical community. It's kind of like dating. Like, you know, you don't want to talk about how bitter you are about guys because of all your past experiences, which is, I know, it's a really weird analogy.
But that makes sense.
Yeah, that doctor might be the one, and you don't want to, you know, give up on that.
So how did you at one point research your therapies and treatments?
Well, right now what I do is I actually don't, when I hear about something that might help, I don't go to Google first. I actually ask friends who are better informed about this stuff than I am and who I know are critical thinkers, and see if they have links. And hopefully there's peer-reviewed studies, if not just good information. And then the next thing is, who benefits from this? Because with CFS, there's lots of different etiologies, and a treatment that really works well for people with neurological symptoms might not help me, because I don't, as far as we know, I don't have those.
And CFS is?
I'm sorry, chronic fatigue syndrome.
Right.
That's my main complaint, the thing that actually disabled me. So if it does seem like this treatment is for someone like me, who is post-viral, most likely, I like to read anecdotes from people who are also going through the therapy. And then finally, I bring it to my doctor and we talk about it.
So I have to ask, before you started researching, what kind of alternative therapies did you try that maybe you realized later weren't evidence-based?
The main thing is like immune-boosting stuff, like echinacea, airborne, that sort of thing. Mm-hmm. And I really believed it worked because, you know, I would take it before I felt like I was getting sick, and I'd drink a lot of water, and I would get a lot of sleep. Lo and behold, the next day I woke up and I felt better. And when I got too lazy in the end to sort of buy this stuff and use it, it turned out that I had the exact same results. And so that was a pretty good demonstration that, you know, why bother?
So are these kind of things the reason that you started the blog?
Not consciously. You know, originally the idea, and this is still the idea of the blog, is that it's basically disability, coming to terms with it from a geeky point of view. But the thing is, I was looking back on it recently and saw that it only took me one post to get into my atheism, and then like I think another two posts before I was writing about skepticism. So I think subconsciously maybe I did, but I didn't really understand right away that it was possible for like just a schmuck like me to get involved in the discussion. And as I've done more reading and the blog has progressed, I've discovered that isn't actually true.
Obviously not. And it's a great blog. So where can people find the blog?
The blog is at Newly Nerfed. Nerfed being a game term for being sort of weakened. N-E-W-L-Y, newly-nerfed.net. Or if you just type newly nerfed into Google, I think you'll find it.
Perfect. Well, thanks very much for being here, Joey, and it's a great topic.
Thank you so much for having me. It was great to be here.
So if you out there have a great topic to discuss or an event to promote, come and tell us about it on Speaking Up. You can find out more on our website at skepticallyspeaking.com, and we have a brand new Speaking Up page there. So just click the link on the right-hand side for details. And we'll be right back to explore ethics in human research right after this.
Skeptically Speaking wants you to question everything. To be part of the discussion, call in every Friday from 6 to 7 Mountain Time at 780-492-2577, extension 1. That's 780-492-2577, extension 1. You can also email your questions and comments before or during the show to live@skepticallyspeaking.com, or if you're on Twitter, at Skeptical Radio. After the show, continue the conversation on our website at skepticallyspeaking.com, or check out our Facebook group. You can also subscribe to our podcast on iTunes, and while you're there, why not add a review of the show? Skeptically Speaking also airs on Citywide LP 99.1 FM in Madison, Wisconsin, Public Reality Radio, WPRR 1680 AM in Grand Rapids, Michigan, Rosslyn 101.1 in Rosslyn, British Columbia, and on freethoughtradio.com. And now, back to the show.
Welcome back to Skeptically Speaking, and I'm your host, Desiree Schell. I have a brief announcement before we get to Nancy Walton and human research ethics. We'd like to welcome a new station to the Skeptically Speaking family. CJAI Amherst Island Public Radio 92.1 FM on Amherst Island in Ontario recently started airing our show. So thanks very much, those of you who made that brilliant programming decision. Brilliant. We really appreciate it. And you can visit their website and show them some love at cjai.ca. So today I'm very pleased to have Nancy Walton on the line. Nancy completed her PhD in bioethics at the University of Toronto. She's an associate professor teaching ethics and professional issues in the School of Nursing at Ryerson University and is chair of the University-wide Research Ethics Board. She's also a member of research ethics boards at the Toronto Hospital for Sick Children and the Ontario College of Art and Design. She's the co-author of a textbook on contemporary legal and ethical issues in nursing and the author of the popular research ethics blog. Welcome, Nancy.
Thanks, Desiree.
Thanks very much for being here.
My pleasure.
So you're on many research ethics boards.
Three currently.
So
it's
a
lot of work.
I bet. So what do they do exactly?
Research ethics boards function to review human subject research going on in the institution, either within the institution or by researchers who have affiliations with the institution. They're technically supposed to be a quote-unquote independent body, but they really function at arm's length to the institution. They review research for ethical soundness. They're not a peer review sort of board, so they're not deciding whether the research is worth doing or not from the point of view of that specific discipline. But they're there to look at research before it begins, look at things like risk and benefit, whether participants are sufficiently informed and consented, and to protect really the best interests of participants.
Okay, so what kind of, are there a kind of issues that a board looks at? Like, are there certain issues?
Yeah, there's lots.
Okay.
And it really depends on the kind of research that a board is reviewing. For example, I sit on the board at the Ontario College of Art and Design. So the kind of research we're looking at there is very different from, say, the research we're looking at the Hospital for Sick Children. Hospital boards typically look at clinical trials, much more biomedically focused research, and the kind of questions that they ask about the research and the kinds of things that they put researchers through before starting their research is far different from researchers who are doing more social science research, that kind of thing. So the kinds of questions we ask with biomedical research are very different than with, say, social science research. So biomedical research, we're looking at, you know, the main thing we're looking at is risk versus benefit. So we're looking at a proposed research project and deciding if the risk that's identified, or the prospective risk that's identified by the researcher, really is in balance with the potential benefit of the study. And then out of that, we're looking at things like informed consent of participants, whether participants are adequately compensated for their time, whether they're protected in terms of confidentiality and privacy, and what are sort of the outcomes? Are they going to get a copy of the report? Are they going to have some kind of involvement that they might want in the research? So those are really, you know, overarching things we look at. And then depending on the kind of research and the identified risk and the population, so at SickKids, we're looking at research mostly on children who we consider to be typically more vulnerable than competent adults, then we look at other things like who's protecting vulnerable groups. So that's a start of what we look at.
Okay, well, to give people a little bit of a case study, let's talk about some historic research that most people have heard of.
Sure.
The Milgram experiment.
Okay, so I can give you a quick overview. Milgram, he actually did a number of experiments, but his most famous experiment was on obedience to authority. And, you know, this research was done to see how people react to legitimate authority. And the research, while vilified in a way, or Milgram was vilified really for conducting what people felt to be unethical research, really gave some perspective into lots of other contextual cases and why people do bad things when they're told to do them, basically. So Milgram took a bunch of participants and he had them administer shocks, electric shocks, to people who they had met, who were actors. And the people who were actors were actually told to answer specific questions, and every wrong answer they gave, the participant, who didn't really know, all they knew was that they were supposed to deliver an electric shock to someone if the person got the answer wrong. And there was someone in the room with them who was an authoritarian figure, telling them, look, that person just got a wrong answer. Deliver a shock to them. And the actor was in the next room, and when the shock was delivered, at a certain point, the actor would say, I think they basically said, my heart hurts. I want to get out of this room. This is painful. I can't take this anymore. And what Milgram's experiments showed was, even when participants heard the actor saying this and understood, for all intents and purposes, that they were delivering painful shocks, they continued to turn the voltage up and deliver higher shocks at the insistence of the authority figure. So the research was helpful in some sense, as helpful as maybe the wrong word. The research gave us a lot of information about why people do bad things when they're told to do, you know, very bad things that they wouldn't do normally in another context. But it was retrospectively, people said, well, the research, people weren't informed of what they were doing, which they couldn't have been because deception was part of the research method. But people had long-term and short-term traumatic experiences,
Absolutely.
Traumatic effects from taking part in it.
Now, that research, even without being on a research ethics board, seems unethical. So how did that get past an ethics board?
Well, at the time Milgram did it, research ethics boards are a fairly new phenomenon. So at the time Milgram did it, there wasn't, you know, a research ethics board in that institution telling him, you know, you have to do it a certain way. Now, Milgram has been replicated about 2 years ago by a researcher, and actually those results have been published. And the replication of Milgram was done, and it did get through a research ethics board. He changed some of the things that he did. His last name was Berger. He changed some of Milgram's methods in order to make it more ethically sound.
How so?
A couple of things he did. First of all, an interesting thing about Milgram's experiments was when people were delivering shocks at about 150 voltage measurement, it was called a point of no return. And if people at that point said, I can't do this, I can't hurt this person anymore, they would typically stop. But if instead they listened to the authority figure who was saying, no, no, you have to do this, if they continued, they tended to go up to the maximum, i.e. the fatal dose of electricity. So what Berger did in his replication of Milgram's experiment was say, let's not have anyone deliver a supposed shock past 150, because we know we have some predictions about their behavior past that point. The other thing he did was that he debriefed people almost immediately. So at that 150-volt point, whatever they decided, whether it was to stop, they just said, I can't do this, or they said, well, okay, I'd continue. He stopped the experiment immediately, brought the actor in who said, look, I'm okay, I never got any shocks, and people were debriefed immediately. That's what, that, you know, according to, you know, he has published his findings in a journal called American Psychologist, and there's a section that probably could be, I think, a little more rigorous on sort of the ethical, the changes he made to make the experiment more ethically sound. But it was passed by an ethics board.
Okay, audience, if you have questions about the how and why of human research ethics, give us a call at 780-492-2577, extension 1, email live at skepticallyspeaking.com, or tweet Skeptical Radio. Okay, so Nancy, looking back on something like the Milgram experiment, if it hadn't been reproduced with these alterations, does that negate the entire study and its findings?
You know, when we're looking at experiments like this, there's enough data that there is quantitative data, so they can say, you know, this is statistically significant that people, for example, obeyed authority in these certain situations. So Milgram's experiment on its own, without the replication, is still considered to be not only groundbreaking, but also relevant. And, you know, there's been other experiments that have sort of, in some ways, addressed the same phenomenon, such as, you know, Philip Zimbardo's Stanford prison experiment, that sort of thing. So there have been other different kinds of research that have supported Milgram's findings without, you know, doing anything close to what Milgram did.
But the Stanford prison experiment itself was fraught with ethical issues, was it not?
Absolutely, it was.
Do you want to explain that a bit for the audience?
Sure. The Stanford prison experiment was an experiment in which Philip Zimbardo, who was, I believe, a sociology professor, took a bunch of his graduate students and randomized them into a living experiment where they were going to be basically quarantined into an environment where they were either prisoners or guards. And so students agreed to take part, which is a problem in and of itself, because we know now that when your professor asks you to take part in a study, you usually say yes, yeah, for lots of different understandable reasons. But, you know, to shorten it a bit, basically he didn't really explain to people how they would be sequestered, how they would be taken from their homes as prisoners by real police officers who he had working with him. And during the course of the experiment, he had video cameras. He wasn't actually in the area where he had the students sequestered. And the students who were the guards took on, you know, they sort of responded to, I guess, what we call a mob mentality. And they took on strong authoritarian roles. They put on sunglasses to avoid prisoners seeing their eyes. They used weapons. They forced prisoners into situations of prisoners who were their colleagues and classmates into extreme situations where they had food and water taken away from them, where they were in isolation, where they had to do extreme physical activity as punishment. They took away their classmates' clothing. They deprived them of sensory stimulation by covering their eyes and, you know, things like that. So it was only stopped when someone blew the whistle, because Philip Zimbardo basically let it continue to happen. And, you know, a lot of people say it was, you know, a fascinating sociological experiment that shows how quickly, you know, your average sociology grad student can become a strong authoritarian, you know, with a really bad attitude. Mm-hmm. But, you know, when you look at it, you also have to look at how it was done. And there is that tension because it has, you know, been helpful in understanding other phenomenon. It's just, you know, the way it was done was, as you said, highly ethically problematic.
Now, we actually have something interesting here. Earlier in the day, our sound engineer actually commented on the blog about the Stanford prison experiment, and he has spontaneously showed up in the booth. And I think he has a question.
Sure.
Oh, Mike here. I was an undergraduate at Stanford in the late 60s, and I was in Professor Zimbardo's Psych 101 class. And all us undergraduates were required by the curriculum to take part in some of the psych experiments. And I was in his replication of the Milgram study, which was interesting. Yes, wow. There I was, the little red button in front of me and a meter, and a graduate student as an actor on the other side of the double glass wall expressing pain when he read the wrong words from a list on a piece, or remembered the wrong words from a list I had read him.
Wow. So what did that teach you, Mike?
Well, it taught me a distrust of authority figures, but it's interesting that I was not debriefed immediately after the experiment, as Berger did. This was more closer to the original Milgram study in that I didn't find out until a few years later that I hadn't actually given anybody any shocks.
Really?
When I read a write-up on the experiment and on the Milgram experiment. And it did give me a pretty permanent distrust of psychology professors.
Yeah, that's understandable.
Thanks, Mike.
Made me a big fan of Eric Fromm, too.
So, Nancy, should this research still be used as reference then?
Oh, that's a huge question. To some degree, I think, yes, in some ways it should be. You know, in two ways. And one may be in a stronger way than the other. And the first way that it can be used is to look at, you know, bad design, bad ethical experiments.
Right.
And that's how we commonly reference them when we're teaching students about research ethics. These are classic cases that we refer to. So there is some, you know, definitely something to be learned from that. I think that, you know, the findings from this experiment are, from both of these experiments, are, you know, to some degree insightful. And, you know, I'm torn when I say that because, you know, you're saying that in the context of, you know, real people who were significantly traumatized and treated in an unethical way, to then say, yes, but we learn from that something about the way people are obedient or not obedient to legitimate authority. So, you know, there's no easy answer, Desiree.
Well, audience, again, you can talk to Nancy Walton, chair of Ryerson University Research Ethics Board at 780-492-2577, extension 1, also by email at live@skepticallyspeaking.com or on Twitter at Skeptical Radio. Mike has another comment.
Well, while I'm here, sure. I'm going to say that just as when a war happens, we're not afraid to learn from the experience of the war that wars are a very bad idea. And I think we can generalize the research particularly, well, of Milgram and Zimbardo's experiments, and particularly the Stanford prison experiment. Besides learning something about research ethics, we also did learn something about prison in that experiment. And just as we shouldn't throw out the lessons of a war because people were unjustly killed, we can't throw out the lessons of that research because people were badly treated either. And it gave us a pretty clear message that a prison can take apparently normal people and cause them to do evil things.
I think Mike's point is a really good one, and the only sort of way I'd bracket that a little bit is to say, but these experiments were done, they're in a, you know, these are controlled, quote unquote, experiments that are done in the name of academic advancement. So, you know, whereas a war really is beyond the control of the people, sociologists, psychologists, anthropologists who want to learn from it and want to sort of generate knowledge about, you know, really terrible phenomenon. These experiments were done by individual academics in so-called controlled environments. So I think Mike's point is a very good one, that we often learn really important things from very perceived, very negative, you know, situations. I guess I would just add that to his point.
OK. Okay, well, away from prison. So the word ethical has a much different meaning at the Research Ethics Board than it does in regular conversation.
I guess it does. I'm so used to using it that it probably, for me, it, doesn't have that much difference. But I think when we talk about ethics in everyday life, a lot of people are talking about their own values.
Right.
A lot of people are talking about religion and morality. And when we're talking about ethics on a research ethics board, we can't be talking about religion. We can't be talking about our own personal, strongly held values and beliefs about what we think is right. We're really referring to shared, to some degree, shared principles and guidelines, and ensuring that research occurs respecting those kinds of principles.
I think probably a good example of the difference in semantics, I guess, mm-hmm. is one of the Duke sex toys study.
Yeah.
Would you tell us a story, Nancy?
There's a researcher at Duke who was doing research, and the research involved inviting female undergrad, I think it was undergrad students, to parties where they would be allowed to buy sex toys. And the Catholic priest at the university objected to this research, saying that it doesn't promote, you know, relationships or healthy relationships. Actually, Chris blogged about this. He's the one who brought the story to our attention.
And Chris is?
And Chris McDonald, my co-author on the Research Ethics blog, who you actually interviewed on this show in June.
Way back in the day.
But the main point about the Duke sex toy story is that we shouldn't. You know, institutions and research ethics boards, let's say, aren't going to say, you know, this research isn't good because it, you know, doesn't embrace, you know, say Catholic values, mm-hmm. or, you know, good Catholic values or good Anglican values or whatever. That's not the role of a research ethics board. Our role is to look at sort of broader kinds of principles and values, societally held values. So a research ethics board would probably listen to someone like that. And actually, he's criticizing the researchers directly, not per se the research
right.
ethics board that passed the research or approved the research. But I think a research ethics board would say, you know, this is research that's generalizing knowledge about something. It's not, you know, and the objection, certainly someone would listen, but it's not really the grounds upon which you would stop research, let's say.
Well, is there a lot of disagreement coming from, I guess, different people using different standards of ethics as opposed to disagreement over the methodology itself?
Yeah, there's a lot of...
You sound tired when you say that.
Yeah, I am.
Yeah.
No, I'm not. It's sort of a how many hours do you have kind of thing. There's disagreement about both. And the overarching disagreement, I think, is about what a research ethics board should be doing. Because some people think, and some people within the research ethics world think, that a research ethics board should be looking at the soundness of methodology. You know, whether something is going to generate generalizable, useful knowledge. And that's really asking one body to do everything. And it's impossible to have that level of expertise and understanding about not just the ethical implications of a study, but the methodology and the statistical analysis. And research ethics boards have a lot of expertise on it. And we consult, you know, with external people when we need additional expertise. But that's an ongoing debate about how far do you get into the methodology. You know, and to some degree, it's an interesting debate, because if you look at a study that isn't going to generate really good, usable, valuable knowledge, is that an ethical issue? Because you're wasting the time of participants, potentially.
Right.
You know, and I read, for example, I read a lot of graduate research. So these are graduate students who are really evolving scientists. They're evolving researchers. It's their first, you know, opportunity doing research, and they're very fresh. And quite often you read their proposed studies and you have to review it, and you know that they're really not, you know, they're doing their best. let's, you know, I'm not, but they're not going to, the question they're asking in their research, and they're maybe interviewing participants for 2 hours, they're not going to answer with how they're asking the questions.
Right.
So, you know, so you're saying, is that ethically problematic that you're wasting, you know, 2 hours of someone's time when the thesis won't get published, maybe, or there'll be problems and the study will have to be changed. So there's always questions about whether methodology is an ethical, you know, or problematic methodology is an ethical issue. And I think you could talk to 10 different research ethics boards and they'd have 10 different ways of looking at that.
How much effect would you say that lobbying has on a research ethics board? And I understand they're supposed to be a neutral party.
Lobbying by, say, researchers themselves?
Well, let's say with the Duke University incident, that gentleman is only targeting the researchers themselves. But what if they did target the Research Ethics Board? Can you be moved?
I think that at that point, you know, it's not, there's really quite specific sort of reasons in which we would stop a study. And again, you know, you're talking about a social science study, the sex toy study, versus a biomedical study. There's, you know, there's different endpoints in which a research ethics board would clearly say, stop this study now, or we recommend this study be stopped. So it's not really a matter of lobbying, no. And I always hate to say this, but I think a research ethics board would fall back on the guidelines and the principles that they have to say, you know, unless something has changed, we approved the research in this form. So it's gone through all the sorts of evaluative and review procedures, and it's been approved. So unless something is markedly changed that's brought to our attention, lobbying wouldn't really make us say, oh, well, gosh, that it is a bad idea then. We approved it, but, you know, in retrospect, we should stop it. So there are pretty clear situations in which we'd stop research, and lobbying by another, you know, party saying we don't like this research or it doesn't fit with our values wouldn't be a reason for us to say, well, then it should be stopped.
Well, we have a related question from the website that was sent in before the show. Go ahead, Ryan.
How much has stem cell research suffered due to the public perception of the ethics?
You know what? That's a difficult question to answer. I think that on one hand, there are people out there who are very anti-stem cell research or anything, you know, involving stem cells. But there is a significant group of people who are very proactive and very vocal about furthering stem cell research. And, you know, they're not all, you know, they're advocates for different reasons. And so I'm not sure that there's a shared public perception, first of all. I think there are the two extremes, and I think there's a lot of people in the middle who are either ill-informed, uninformed, or don't really care. So I think that there'll always be people who want to be involved in that kind of research. And there's always, you know, and I'm talking sort of healthy public people, the people in the public who want to get involved in studies. But also, you know, there are patients, like inpatients, who have significant problems, whether it's, you know, Alzheimer's, whether it's heart disease, and the advances that have been made in those areas, for example, using stem cells, are such that if that, you know, that person might be completely anti-stem cells, but when it's their mother and the physician who's responsible for their care is offering them stem cell therapy and saying, you know, it could provide hope in this direction, that direction, you know, it's experimental, but, you know, the other options we have aren't great. I think that people are, you know, on an ad hoc basis persuaded maybe to change their mind. But I think that it's maybe more prevalent in the States, the sort of, you know, strong, divergent sort of beliefs about stem cells. I think in Canada, people are still a bit more open to it, a bit, you know, not sure about it, but willing to learn more. So I think it's more an issue in the States.
Canada and our wonderful civility.
That's right.
Science and ethics, people. Fascinating stuff. You can join our conversation at 780-492-2577, extension 1, by email at live@skepticallyspeaking.com or on Twitter @skepticalradio.
And we will be right back with more after this.
Next week on Skeptically Speaking, we'll be talking with Brent Homan from the Canadian Competition Bureau about their attempts to combat health fraud. Questionable cancer cures, fake vaccines, miracle machines, creams, and treatments. What's the government doing to educate consumers and smack down the bad guys, and is it working? Find out on the next Skeptically Speaking, every Friday at 6 p.m. Mountain Time, here on CJSR.
Welcome back to Skeptically Speaking, and I'm your host, Desiree Schell. Before we get back to Nancy Walton, chair of the Ryerson University Research Ethics Board, I'd like to remind you that we are looking for a new theme song. We've received some entries, and they're actually good, obviously made by people with musical talent. So thank you very much, everyone. But we're greedy, and we want more. So again, we're looking for 60-second long CD-quality original submissions. You can send them to us at feedback@skepticallyspeaking.com, and please put theme song in the subject line. If you're interested, you have until the end of the year to do it. And do keep in mind that you are doing this for no compensation other than the knowledge that we think you're great. So, Nancy, we actually have some listener questions on the website, but our phone just rang at exactly the same time. So let me ask you about something completely different.
Okay.
Part of what we've been talking about the entire show is what you do involves determining the value of research for the social good versus the individual good in a lot of ways.
Mm-hmm. To some degree, yeah.
So some people would say that that would be a justification for torture research.
Some people would, and this probably is the best example. I mean, this is like taking the sex toys example and, you know, exponentially, you know, blowing that up. Just to give the listeners some background, we've put a couple of stories on our blog about research on torture, and specifically physicians being involved in research on torture. This is, you know, an example of very much what we've talked about. We talked about Milgram and Zimbardo's experiments of, you know, research that has, for many people, questionable social value. We need to understand not only good things, but we need to also have understanding of things that aren't, you know, very good, to put it trailly, things that are, you know, extremely bad, including violence against different people. And within, you know, a public sort of domain, there's lots of research going on about violence against women or child abuse or phenomenon that we actually say, wow, there needs to be more research on that. But when it comes down to something like torture, people, you know, tend to say this is problematic and we shouldn't be doing research on this. You know, a research ethics board, to go back to sort of the roles and responsibilities of that, probably wouldn't touch research on torture with a, you know, with a 10-foot pole.
Right.
That is to say, prospective research. So research that someone wants to do on torture. Whereas if someone said, you know, they wanted to look back at all the research on torture and publish something about that, probably people would be very encouraging of that. You know, what can we learn from it?
Right.
So, you know, it's a really, you know, it's a very difficult question. And again, our role is not per se to assess. It is to some degree, absolutely, to assess social value of research. But it's not up to us to say, well, it's difficult for us to say there isn't social value in learning about bad things as well as good things, because obviously that's, you know, extremely important. And you're talking about people's individual values. As a society, we have, you know, a shared value for the most part that torture's bad. But we've come to that understanding through what we know about it. So, you know, even for us to get that far to say as a society we are against torture for the following reasons, because it has the following effects on people, we've learned that through
right.
the experience of it. So, yeah, it's a really, really difficult question, Desiree. I keep saying that.
That's all right. I was actually just noting that. I'm just thinking, I ask great questions today.
You do.
We actually have a caller on the line. Go ahead, caller.
Hi, how are you?
I'm well. How are you? Who are you and where are you from, sir?
I'm in Edmonton. My name is Rita.
Perfect.
I have a couple of questions, actually. First of all, you'd mentioned something about Catholics approaching you and some of the studies that were performed and asking you for your feedback. How much weight do you give to religions, period, when it comes to research?
In terms of evaluating it from an ethical standpoint, we don't really. I mean, if you were at, let's say, a Catholic university that identified, just to use Catholicism as an example, if you were at a university that clearly identified itself as a Catholic university, for example, or, an institution with overarching values and principles that align with Catholicism, that's something that would be different. A research ethics board existing in an institution like that may actually, have different perspective. But religion
about
wouldn't come in, because even
board,
in a research
actually.
Ethics board, you've got maybe 10, 20 people sitting around the table of, diverse religious beliefs, diverse values. And so to, say that one should speak to the ethical soundness of research would be highly problematic.
All right, Rita, I hope that answered your question. We actually have another call on the line. Go ahead, caller.
Hello.
Hi, who are you and where are you calling from?
My name is Malcolm. I'm calling from Edmonton.
Hello.
Hi, Malcolm.
I'm calling to address something that your guest said regarding stem cells. I thought that her argument about why people objected was disingenuous. She seemed to suggest that people objected to stem cell research because they were stem cells rather than how the stem cells were harvested, specifically that they came from fetuses. And surely that is a much more significant issue than just the fact that they're stem cells.
Thanks. I didn't really identify one of the other objections. If I did, I certainly didn't mean to, because people certainly have a variety of objections if they're objecting to stem cell research, whether it's simply, something to do with the actual research, something to do with the fact that stem cells are being used, or, as you said, a very common objection is how they're harvested and the use of them, subsequent to that harvesting. So, I don't disagree with you at all.
Well, I appreciate you saying that. I would say that when addressing that issue in the future, it would be valuable to cite some of the reasons rather than, from what I could see, giving a more dismissive approach to people's objection, because, after all, harvesting human tissue of any point of origin from non-voluntary donors should alarm people.
For instance,
if it was the fetus that was of your baby, you would find that objectionable. In the same way that, for instance, tissue harvested from Chinese prisoners or U.S. prisoners against their will would surely ring moral, ethical alarm bells for all of us.
And this is a very controversial issue. Absolutely.
Absolutely.
Thanks very much for calling.
Thank you.
Thank you.
So there are a variety of issues on all of the ethical considerations that we're talking about today. Another controversial one is orphaned and adopted children. There was fairly recently a study on that as well.
This study was actually a Romanian study, and the researchers, it was published in the American Journal of Psychiatry, and the editor, interestingly enough, when the results were published, also wrote a fairly extensive and compelling editorial about the research, which I actually found almost as interesting as the actual research. But researchers in Romania wanted to look at psychiatric and health outcomes of orphaned children who were institutionalized versus those who were in foster care. And when you look at that right off, at first glance, you say, that seems like unethical research. It seems like we already know that children who are in a home, we think we know that if children are in a home with a guardian or a foster parent, it must be better than institutional life. But, there's a couple of things about this study that were most interesting. First, there was no such thing. At the time this research was done, there was no foster care program at all in Romania. And the researchers knew about, obviously, all the Western studies citing foster care as being highly superior to institutional care. And that's the basis upon which, you know, a lot of programs for children in the Western world are based on that research. So the researchers knew about this research, but in order for them to, they felt, to convince Romanian policymakers, Romanian officials, that a foster care program should be instituted in Romania, they knew they had to offer some sort of really definitive research. And, you know, policymakers want things like random controlled trials, which this was. This was a randomized controlled trial in which some children were put into an arm where they stayed in an institution, and some children they left the institution, were put into foster care. And over time, psychiatric and health outcomes were measured and compared of the two groups. So when they found that, in fact, children did better in foster care, they could present that very definitive research to policymakers in order to justify their push towards foster care. And the other thing about this study, you know, it's really important to consider context. If you were doing this study, say, in downtown Edmonton or downtown Toronto or downtown Montreal, it probably wouldn't take the same form. An ethics board wouldn't let it take the same form because they would say, you know, there's a lot of literature out there already that says we already know that foster care is better. We're not sort of learning anything new. So the context is important. The other thing that was important about this study is to really, people really need to look at what the question was the researchers were asking. And they weren't asking, is foster care better than institutional care? They were asking, if children are transitioned from an institution to foster care, do they do okay?
Right.
Because obviously all the children that they would be that would be affected by the outcome of the study and subsequent policy decisions would be children who are in institutions. And they had significant concerns about whether children who were always institutionalized from the time of you know, being conscious of their lived environment would have significant traumatic effects from being transitioned to foster care. And that is actually a really important question that even in the Western literature, you know, there's some about it, but there's maybe not enough. So, you know, at first glance, that study, even when I first read it, I went, oh, that sounds problematic at best. And then when I looked a little, you know, deeper, read the editorial, looked at the actual study, I changed my mind. And I think that is, you know, a good exercise when you think about what a research ethics board does, is that they look at, hopefully, they look at things that thoroughly, right, and say, you know, really what's trying to be done here. Look, they look at the contextual circumstances, hopefully, and can help facilitate research like that, that maybe at first glance people would say, no, can't do it.
And we are almost out of time, and trying to choose between the two questions that, you know, I'm sorry, the other people who I didn't get to your questions at all today, but I'm going to ask you what I think possibly is my favorite question that I've ever received on the website.
Okay.
Go ahead, Ryan.
Let's say we divert all military spending into space travel and build a base on another planet, only to discover that below the surface there is life. How do we treat this new life? And bonus question, what if it's tasty?
I think that's a great question.
That seems like a question better left unanswered.
That was subtle.
I think I don't have the expertise to answer that. I was very afraid I wouldn't be able to answer a question, but I think I can confidently say that I'd be open to a lot of other perspectives on the answer to that question. I don't even know if that constitutes research, to be honest.
Well, it is life, and it is living underground, and we're going to have to probably do some research on it. So I wonder what kind of ethical concerns would be at hand there.
Well, I think that, this is really, you know, off the top of my head. You know, we have research ethics, people who are concerned with research ethics for experimentation involving animals. We have, you know, separate bodies that deal with that. And we have, obviously, research ethics boards that look at human experiments. And, you know, research ethics boards also look at experiments with tissue, with blood, with all kinds of other biological products. So where it would fall, probably, I you'd have to form a whole new sort of ethics board dealing with the extraterrestrial life.
I think that was a good answer, Nancy.
Thank you.
And that is absolutely our time for today. Thanks so much for being on the show, Nancy.
Thanks, Desiree. It was a pleasure.
And you can check out Nancy's writing at researchethics.ca. And I do have to point out, it is one of my favorite blogs.
Thank you.
Absolutely. And of course, you can visit our website at skepticallyspeaking.com, where you'll find links that allow you to follow us on Twitter, join our Facebook page, or subscribe in iTunes. And if you'd like to help get the word out, you could review our show in iTunes, or you could link to us from your blog or website. We appreciate that. Now, all of us are off to we're actually going to attend Virtual Drinking Skeptically, and it's exactly what it sounds like it would be. You can check virtualds.wordpress.com for information on how to join us there, and we'll be back with a report on it next episode. So thanks for listening, and we'll see you next week on Skeptically Speaking.
South America does not exist. The moon is painted on the sky. Things sometimes fall off, but you never see. And everything you believe is a lie.
Dinosaurs were invented by God as a test. Our bodies don't rot when we die. All the hippies are working for the government, and everything you believe is a lie.
Everything you believe is a lie.